The next case for argument is Seifert v. Alexander. Ms. Lattice.
May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Lattice, and I'm representing Mr. Jim Alexander and the individual members of the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. And, Your Honors, this case today goes to the heart of the state's ability to fashion its own judicial system. The three judicial canons at issue here, which we ask you to consider individually, do not implicate core issues of a candidate for judge telling the voters about his or her qualifications for office. Instead, these canons go to the heart of what Wisconsin says is the compelling interest to preserve the impartiality and the appearance of integrity of the courts by keeping partisan politics out of the judiciary and the judiciary out of partisan politics. And then secondly, to regulate solicitation of campaign funds at the one point where it's most likely to have coercive effect.
What level of scrutiny do you think we should be applying in reviewing these?
That's the main issue in the case, Your Honor, and I believe it should be an intermediate level of scrutiny, such as the court applied in the letter carriers case, such as the court applied in the campaign finance cases. It does not implicate the same core issues of speech that the Supreme Court spoke about in the White case, because the White case involved speech on that most important issue of a candidate for political office telling the voters about his or her qualifications to hold political office. None of the canons at issue here involve that same matter. For one thing, Judge Seifert wants to engage in here relates to his conduct as a judge, not to his speech on elections. Similarly, the speech on soliciting campaign donations is not speech on his qualifications for office, and the courts have not looked at it in that way.
Could I just go back a little bit, because the amicus brief of the Conference of Chief Judges, or rather, Chief Justices, asserts that we need not apply strict scrutiny to the solicitation portion of the claim, because solicitations are not communications. To support that notion, the brief cites the Supreme Court cases of Buckley and McConnell.
Yes.
But it seems to me that these cases addressed whether contributions were a form of communication, as opposed to solicitations, although one might argue that giving a gift of money is not communication, clearly the solicitation, that is the statement, would you please contribute to my campaign, constitutes speech, doesn't it?
It could be speech in the purest sense of the word, but it's not speech on the individual's qualifications for office. What it is what it is, a request for money. And there are many places where the government and the courts themselves have regulated the time, place, and manner in which individuals who are running for office can make requests for funds. So, for example, cases have been upheld holding that federal members of Congress, for example, can't ask federal employees for money in federal buildings. It's that same kind of, it's not pure speech in that sense. It's the sort of speech that can be regulated in order that we balance the very important countervailing constitutional interests here of protecting the process of elections.
Why is it more important to prevent citizens from feeling compelled or coerced to contribute to a judicial campaign than it is to prevent them from feeling compelled or coerced in a legislative campaign or, let's say, a local aldermanic campaign where the elected official really does have a direct impact on things that affect the citizen on a day-to-day basis.
Judges have extraordinary power over individuals as well, Your Honor, but I think that gets to the heart of the difference between the between judges and judging and the courts and the legislative body. The entire system is different. Judges are not politicians. Judges cannot run for office and say, I promise to do this and that if you vote for me in exchange for your votes, which is exactly what we expect politicians to do. Politicians, in fact, have to do that. So it's a an entirely different situation between the two. Regarding the coercive effect and why we've chosen or we asked to be able to draw the line here at this direct solicitation line, because that's the place where the individual is likely to feel the most threatened, the most coerced into, the most uncomfortable, put in the most uncomfortable position. It creates a bad appearance both from the standpoint of the individual, and remember, Your Honor, we have many small counties in Wisconsin. We have many cases where there's only one judge, where a judge's power to affect individuals is every bit as great as your alderman. But it creates both the appearance that this judge may be asking for money in exchange for potential favors, and it certainly creates the fear or the coercion, the uncomfortability in the recipient of the direct solicitation.
Well, now, if the rule against being a member of a political party serves this compelling interest, how is it that Wisconsin can allow it for judicial candidates in political office? If the interest is that compelling, shouldn't judicial candidates be required to resign their political positions before they run?
That, Your Honor, was an attempt of the state to narrowly tailor the rule as much as possible and to keep open the possibility that as many people as possible who wanted to could run for judge and didn't have to give up their current positions in order to do so. The rule, however, on maintaining that party registration, if you will, that party identification, is very restricted. Let's say it's a legislator who's running for judge. That legislator can engage in party politics and party identity issues only insofar as it's required for him to handle his duties as a legislator. In other words, he can still caucus with the Republicans while he's running for judge, but he, other than that, doesn't get any greater rights towards party identification than any other candidate would get.
Well, isn't it odd to allow judges to attend a public event sponsored by a political party, but not allow a judge to announce her political party?
Again, that was an attempt to try and be as least restrictive as possible in order to preserve the constitutionality of it. The idea is that we would like to present it's well understood that judges come from other positions, and many judges. Former political persuasions are well known. That's the reality in the state. But at the time that the judge becomes judge, the judge the judge sets aside that past party identification, that past partisanship. The judge puts on the robe of nonpartisanship and presents the appearance.
That's a little different. That's after the election and upon being sworn in. Your rule includes during the campaign. There can be no party affiliation unless you happen to be in an elective office already.
That's correct. That's correct. And that is how the rule does read, that where we are also interested in the individual representing him or herself to the voters as a nonpartisan candidate for judge.
But isn't that an odd dichotomy? I mean, you continually say that it's to narrow the ruling, but it's such an odd dichotomy. For instance, can a secret Republican suppress her bias and decide a case with political significance any better than someone who declares her alliance with the Republican Party? There's so many.
No, I understand, and no, that isn't what we're trying to say, because you can't obviously know what's in any judge's heart. What is important here is the appearance that the judiciary is presenting to the public, that that every litigant that stands before every judge understands that that judge is nonpartisan, not a member, not an outspoken member of any political party.
Ms. Lattice, could I return you for a moment to the endorsement question? I appreciate the point you're making on the possible coercion or the appearance of coercion. But is there a speech component in the asking of a particular entity, let's say a trade union or a chamber of commerce, that you're making some statement about your views by that particular solicitation, and maybe you intend to. Now, of course, a candidate could ask from a whole variety of folks to contribute, but is there something apart from coercion in just the asking? Doesn't that tell you that I'm in all likelihood identified with your agenda? From a speech speech component on the solicitation by the individual candidate.
Are you drawing a distinction between seeking an endorsement from a group and seeking campaign funds from a group?
The solicitation for funds by the candidate individually.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't think I followed the question. I was starting off.
Candidate A is running for a judicial post. And he seeks to get not endorsement, but he wants to solicit personally the head of a trade union or the chamber of commerce. Doesn't he have a speech component in seeking the monies?
He does have a speech component. It's just a speech component that can be balanced against the other ills that we use in order to minimize. In order to protect the process and minimize the coercive effect upon the process. So I'm not denying that that's not an act of some speech.
More than literal speech. You approach an entity that is clearly aligned with a series of issues and ask for funds apart from endorsement. I guess you always hope that would follow the funds. Isn't that, in all likelihood, a statement that I'm aligning myself with the principal points of your entity, your organization?
Yeah, and it could be, and our rule certainly doesn't prevent a judicial candidate from saying I align myself with the positions that are important to your organization. What it does do is prevent the judge from directly asking for money.
What if the candidate's brother or sister is the campaign? I mean, is the insulation that you have? Is that's the big difference? You know, you can have your brother as the campaign manager.
Yes,
and that's okay, and the public.
What we'd like to do is be able to just draw that one line at the area where we think the effect is the most coercive, and that is the judge himself buttonholing, strong-arming, you know, whatever you may want to do for funds.
Are you suggesting that different rules might apply to those judicial candidates who are already employed by the state, as opposed to those candidates who are merely campaigning and are not state employees?
No, the rules apply to the same rules apply to all candidates. There's only that one distinction for individuals that have to do something in a partisan manner to continue to fulfill their duties.
Is there a fee for political affiliation in Wisconsin? Do you have to pay money to become a Democrat or Republican or whatever?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know how the parties handle that.
Or do you just declare I'm a whatever?
Well, we have an open primary system, so there is no necessity to declare a party affiliation.
So our plaintiff just wants to declare that he's one party or the other as part of his
That's correct. He wants to be able to say that he is a Democrat, and he would like to endorse Democrat candidates for office.
Now, your rules wouldn't prohibit that judge from joining Mothers Against Drunk Drivers or endorsing that group in some way, sending funds to that group or the NRA?
No, our rules would prohibit a judge from joining an advocacy group such as Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and that's the particular example that was in the affidavits. The idea being that a judge telegraphs his or her bias for tough penalties in drunk driving and therefore doesn't appear to be impartial when sitting on a drunk driving case.
How about the National Rifle Association?
I believe that is one of the organizations that they would look at because of the advocacy positions that they take.
How about membership in the Federalist Society or the American Constitution Society?
Those probably not.
Probably not. And would you say today that they carry less of a ideological cast than either of the two major parties?
They carry ideological casts, of course, but and judges can announce their ideological cast, so that's not inconsistent with what Wisconsin's rule is. But what they don't do is telegraph a bias on a particular issue that's very likely to come in front of a judge. And that's the distinction that we're trying to draw.
Your brief continually addresses the issue of whether joining a political party is an essential part of campaign speech. Doesn't Judge Seifert have First Amendment rights to engage in speech even if the speech is not necessary for or even related to his campaign?
Yes, of course. But the idea is that for this speech that's not essential, not part of his explaining his qualifications to office, can be reviewed with an eye towards the necessary balancing that the state has, towards the interest that the state, or I should say that the judiciary itself, has identified as being important. That is to say, to have both, to assure both an impartial judiciary as well as the appearance of an impartial judiciary. One thing I'd like to note here, in particular with regard to the endorsement clause at issue, which we haven't discussed much, is that that's a very common provision for reasons that we've been talking about. Making a partisan endorsement announces to the world that you support a partisan candidate and thereby do not support the opponent to that partisan candidate. So it also is not essential to campaigning. It's also common in many states. It's part of the American Bar Association's model judicial code, certainly part of the federal judicial code, and is not and has been upheld by many of the courts that have considered the issue. So what we do implore this court is to consider the endorsement issue separately from the party identification issue, because they really are two separate issues and ought to be considered the same.
What is the reelection scheme again in Wisconsin after you're elected a judge? You have a specific term.
You have a specific term, and then you must seek re-election. So there's no, it's not a hybrid system.
Yeah, you don't have retention. You actually are subject to another opponent challenging you.
Yes, right. It's and it's a nonpartisan case, so it's open to anyone, and then there would be a primary and then a runoff election.
So if we had a system where the prohibitions that are now in place applied to a judge seeking re-election, he would be disadvantaged because if the challenger was able to make identification and he were not, is that why you preclude any identification whatsoever with the political party?
Right. That's why we try and limit it to that very, very narrow situation where an individual, you know, would. We don't want someone to have to resign their job to run for judge, but so we recognize that there's that narrow. But other than that, no. Any other individual who had past party ties would have to go forward and run for judge as a nonpartisan. And I the final point that I'd like to make here, Your Honors, is that the court in the Massey decision, in the Massey versus Caperton decision, I think really the hook in that case is very significant to our case here, because what the court understood there is that appearances in the judiciary are really what matters. That's the heart of what respect the court can demand. The court has to look impartial. It's very hard to force any individuals to be impartial, but they need to look impartial. They need to look like they have integrity in order for the public and the litigants to have confidence in the court. And that is what we're asking this court to uphold today.
Thank you, Ms. Lattice. Mr. Neely.
May it please the court. My name is Josiah Neely. I'm attorney for the appellee, John Seifert. And I wanted to begin by going back to the strict scrutiny question. Our position is that the letter carriers cases are not applicable here. Letter carriers involved speech of government employees under the ministerial exception, whereas in this case, first, these provisions apply not only to sitting judges but to candidates who are in no sense a state employee. They don't receive a paycheck from the state. They don't have any control over the state. Second, even when a judge is elected, it's not really accurate to classify them as a straight employee. They're an elected official. Their ultimate responsibility is to the voters. I believe every federal court which has addressed a First Amendment challenge to a state judicial canon, either the ones here in White, all of them have applied strict scrutiny. So our position is that strict scrutiny would apply.
What types of speech restrictions on judges do you suppose would be legitimate under First Amendment analysis? Could a Wisconsin state court judge, for example, take out an advertisement in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says stating that the justices of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin are all inept fools?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. In the case law, the clearest example that's been held where the state could restrict judicial speech has to do with pledges and promises. So the courts have said that a judge can't pledge or promise a specific result in a specific case.
When is Judge Seifert up for re-election, if he chooses to be?
It's next year, I believe.
In 10?
In 2010, yes.
So could Judge Seifert, in advance of that election, while sitting on the bench, wear a button supporting his candidacy and perhaps his state rep and his congressional candidate? You know, the way racing drivers have all the emblems of sponsors? Could he sit on the bench? Could there be any restriction on that political speech, such as it is by a campaign button?
Well, Your Honor, to begin with, I'm not sure that that would be prohibited by these canons now, as long as there was nothing about a political party affiliation.
So that wouldn't be any political. That wouldn't be identifying yourself with a party.
If it just says Seifert,
wouldn't that be public endorsement of whoever that button is for?
You are allowed, I believe, under the canons to endorse yourself. You just can't endorse a partisan candidate. And so, actually, you could endorse any judge that you wanted because those are not partisan candidates.
Where do you think the line is on personal solicitations? Is there any behavior surrounding personal solicitations that you think would be so coercive that bias would be unavoidable?
Yes, Your Honor. I think, for example, if a judge were to try and solicit contributions while in court, that would certainly have a...
While
in court from the bench.
Then he'd be taken off to an institution.
I'm not saying it's likely, Your Honor. I'm just saying that would be a fair...
Could you give me something a little more mainstream, shall we say?
Well, I think, and the cases that have dealt with this, both Weaver and White and then several district court cases, have said that the in terms of impartiality, the focus is not really on the solicitation of the contribution, but on the effect that the contribution might have on the impartiality of the judge.
Well, you certainly can't deny that a solicitation is different when a judicial candidate looks you in the eye, cups your hand, asks you to help out.
I think that's true for any candidate, Your Honor. Legislative, I'm sure if you know, the President of the United States asked someone for a contribution, they would feel a great deal of pressure in order to contribute. But no federal court has ever said, either in the judicial context or in the legislative context, that contributors have a right not to feel pressured to contribute. Another example of...
Wait a minute. Explain that to me. I'm the judge.
Right.
Because I'm always the judge.
Right.
And you're the solicitee.
So, yeah.
I come up to you and I say, I really need the money, Mr. Neely. Please. Contribute to me.
Well, I think that's an inherent feature of whenever you have elections. Whenever there are elections, you need to raise contributions, and people are going to feel pressured in order to contribute in certain settings, but that's not a justification for restricting First Amendment rights.
Even though it's coercive in nature, there's a risk of ex parte communications.
Well, I don't believe, Your Honor...
Here you are, you know, you're coming here to see me.
Yeah, I don't believe, Your Honor, that it would be coercive just to ask for a solicitation. If there was some implication of a quid pro quo, or if there was some specific circumstances that heightened...
How can there not be a risk of a quid pro quo in that?
Well, if a judge solicits contributions, I don't know that there would be a quid pro quo by definition. A judge could say something or imply something that there would be a quid pro quo, but it's not inherent in the asking of a solicitation that for a contribution that you're going to do something corrupt or inappropriate in exchange for the contribution. If that were the case, then judges, you wouldn't be able to have contributions at all.
We are so lucky, federal judges. We don't have to have contributions.
I agree, Your Honor.
We are so fortunate.
And I think that raises a key point.
No one would give me anything.
Which is, this is not a case about whether judges should be elected or appointed or whether there should be public financing.
Well, implicitly it is, isn't it? Isn't this a support of the position of appointing judges?
Well, people might draw that conclusion.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you say it's absolutely not one or the other, I think a fair read of this might be that there are some people that are...
Fair enough, Your Honor. My point is simply that the state of Wisconsin has decided in favor of having election of judges. If it decides that the risk from having judges who can solicit or exercise their First Amendment rights is so great they want to move to another system, they can do that. But for now, and in this case, they've decided on the election of judges. One other point which I would like to note from the appellant's argument was the appellant brought up the Supreme Court's case in Caperton. Two things to note about Caperton. The first thing is, and Justice Kennedy went out of his way to note this at the time, is that, you know, that case involved very extreme and extraordinary circumstances. You had a candidate who had, there had been $3 million plus dollars of independent expenditures been expended on his behalf in the campaign while a case was pending. And I don't believe that that would apply across the board, and I believe Justice Kennedy said as much. The other point that I would note is that in that case, the remedy was recusal, and the court held that that recusal was adequate to protect the due process interest at stake in the case. So I don't believe that there's any indication from that case that a direct prohibition, certainly not a blanket prohibition, on solicitation or endorsement or party affiliation would be appropriate.
In Wisconsin, do you have, as they do in the Illinois state courts, a right of a first refusal of the first judge?
I'm not actually a Wisconsin attorney. I don't have the answer to that off the top of my head, Your Honor. But I do know that, Judge Seifert, in his affidavit, has said that the particular candidate that he wanted to endorse was then-candidate Barack Obama for president, and he said that if Barack Obama was ever a party before him, he would recuse himself. So that would not arise as an issue, as unlikely as that may be.
What kind of cases does he hear?
He has been transferred several times, so right now there's a lot of drunk driving, criminal cases. The chances that...
That wasn't a hard promise to make for the judge,
no,
was it?
No. It is very unlikely. But if it did happen, he would certainly recuse himself.
Isn't it a little less appropriate or more unseemly for a judge to participate in party activities than simply affiliate with the party, in other words, to be a whatever party member, but to be a backroom broker of political deals? Isn't that a little difficult for a judge to be perceived as impartial yet doing those kinds of things?
Well, I think that there's certainly a line that a judge could cross in terms of how involved he is in political affairs and with the political party, but party membership, which is what's prohibited here, is vastly on the other side of that line. I don't believe that it even gets close.
True, that's prohibited, but also it prohibits him from participating in the affairs of caucuses, promotions, and so forth, and you're challenging that as well.
I'll put it this way. You know, many judges, including Judge Seifert, prior to becoming candidates for judicial office, were very involved in political caucusing. Judge Seifert was a Clinton-Gore delegate. And the fact that once they become a judge, that's just supposed to disappear, I think involves a double fiction. The first fiction is that just because a judge isn't explicitly affiliated with a party, that they don't have political beliefs. Every judge has political beliefs. And the second fiction is that the public is fooled by this, that they believe just because a judge who may have been a partisan office holder, that now he's a judge, that that's all gone away.
You know, you'd be shocked, I guess, then, to know that it does. When a judge is doing a judge's duty as a judge ought do a judge's duty, it does.
I certainly would agree that when a judge is performing his official duties, he or she is not going to let the partisan beliefs affect what they're doing. But the fact that they have those beliefs doesn't go away.
If the case is affirmed, who's going to police all of this?
Well, ultimately, the decision that Wisconsin has made is for elections, so the judges are ultimately responsible to the voters. And there are numerous cases cited in the brief of judges who have stepped over the line, done something that the voters thought were inappropriate, and they were not reelected or defeated because of it. So ultimately, it's the voters' responsibility.
You see no state interest in precluding sitting judges from not membership in a particular political party, but an activity like perhaps being on a slate-making committee, you know, for candidates. I know it's an indirect endorsement, I guess, if you're on a slate-making.
No, I don't believe so. Certainly, even if there were impartiality concern raised by that, I believe it could be adequately dealt with by recusal.
Well, I know that's always the fallback position, and it's a critical position. Recusal is an important tool in the perception issue, and I know the state gets into the small county question of how easy you bring in somebody else. But is that really going to always be the answer? The short term is the recusal, the long term is the election. Is that your position? In other words, that something happens, hopefully that the judicial officer will recognize that he or she should act in the recusal sense, and if it's greater problem, the electorate will, whenever the term is up, address it.
That is our position. I would also note, however, that even if you thought there was some party activity prohibited by this canon that could be constitutionally prohibited, there is another canon not at issue here that forbids appeals to partisanship. We're not challenging that, so that would still cover it. And B, the canon as it exists would still be substantially overbroad because it would go far beyond anything that could be legitimately prohibited. Third point that Appellees raised has to do with whether candidates are prohibited from being members in advocacy groups, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I just wanted to note for the court, the canon that they cite does not, by its plain language, does not prohibit membership at all in these organizations. And I believe subsequent to the litigation, one of the members of the commission entered an affidavit saying that he believed that they were prohibited from being members by this provision. I don't believe that that's a reasonable interpretation of the statute. However, I would want to bring to the court's attention that the state's theory here is that you could prohibit membership because the group takes an advocacy role and you can assume that the judge would support that advocacy role. That's basically just white. You're saying that the judge has an opinion about a political or legal issue, and therefore you can prohibit him from saying it. This is like that. It's just one more step removed. The judge isn't even speaking, but he's associating with someone who's speaking. You're inferring what he believes from that, and you're saying you want to prohibit that. So I think under both the Republican Party of White and also the subsequent Eighth Circuit case, That's four square within the bounds of White. Final point on the solicitation, I wanted to just stress to the court that the commission in their brief, they disclaim any impartiality interest in the solicitation clause. They base their support for the solicitation clause on potential contributor rights, and specifically the right of contributors not to feel pressured in solicitation. Now, that's something that, as I noted before, is true not only of judges, but for all office holders, and it's not an interest that's ever been recognized by any federal court as compelling and a justification for suppressing freedom of speech. Finally, with regard to the endorsement clause, many of the arguments that the state raises with regard to the endorsement clause are basically the same as for the political affiliation clause, and in the fact that a judge endorses a candidate doesn't create any bias in favor of that candidate. It may be an expression of bias, but if so, prohibiting him from endorsing doesn't take away the bias. It just hides it from the voters and from potential litigants, and it makes it harder for other mechanisms that are already in place to correct for that.
So at bottom line, Mr. Neely, is your position that there can be no cabining of the speech by the state for a judicial candidate or judge?
Not quite, Your Honor. There is a due process interest that litigants have for a judge, which isn't there for a legislature. So potentially there's a difference there, and that does justify some restrictions such as the pledges and promises restriction that I mentioned earlier. But they have to be tied to that due process interest and narrowly tailored to it.
Well, for example, speech by members of the military,
right,
if you choose to be a member of the military, is cabin limited, whatever you want to say. And is it your position that setting aside judicial officers or candidates for judicial office is not something that good public policy of any geopolitical subdivision would want to have in place? Because even in an elective system, which quite often results in semi-life tenure anyway, when one looks at elections or retentions, Illinois, for example, has a retention situation. Rarely has anyone not been retained. Whereas the legislature has a turn.
Although many people in the legislature appear to have life tenure, too.
I appreciate that, and issues like redistricting and come into play, and I know you're aware of that. But you don't see the entity of that role of the judge, like I'm suggesting, occurs with the somewhat monastic setting of a military individual as far as speech is concerned.
There is a due process interest. I certainly think in terms of what judges feel is appropriate decorum, there may be something there. But in terms of a flat-out prohibition, right, by the state, I think that it has to be tied to that due process interest.
Well, I'm sympathetic to your argument about informing the public at the front end of a judicial career,
right,
in the candidacy, and perhaps to maybe a little lesser extent if one's being retained or seeking re-election, because I say to a lesser extent because there's a record hopefully established.
Right.
But there is perceived permanency to the role of the judge until retirement or death or disability, that doesn't attend the other two branches.
Mm-hmm.
There are term limits, and not that a judicial officer couldn't have term limits. How does that play out against speech? You know, what I think you and I could agree is an apparent historical fact.
Right. I believe, first, I would want to stress that there are differences, that the state court judges have a slightly different role than federal judges in that they have a common lawmaking power. So they do wear a quasi-legislative hat at some point, and that is one of the reasons why most states have opted either for straight election, in some cases partisan election, or some sort of retention or hybrid system. But I also think, and I believe the history of the judiciary in Wisconsin bears this out, that self-policing by judges and by the voters does a pretty good job of keeping judges within the bounds of what we would consider appropriate behavior. In this case, you know, the political affiliation clause didn't come into being until 1968. it wasn't applied to candidates until 2004. All the testimony in the case is that long before that, the elections had ceased to be partisan at all. Even before there was, even when the judges were nominally running on behalf of a party, the voters didn't care, and the judges comported themselves as if they were nonpartisan. So I think there's a very strong judicial ethos that judges have, and they care about
you,
it deeply.
You don't think it would be weakened at all, that ethos that you speak of, if we were to go to a somewhat absolutist position in the sense of taking the First Amendment and saying it in no way should limit conduct of a candidate or a judge?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the experience of Wisconsin shows that. I think the experience of other states that allow party membership.
How about the expense that is now seems to attend certain races? I don't want to go outside the record, but
yeah,
we're speaking broadly about policy a little bit here.
Sure. There's certainly been a trend towards more expensive races over the past, but I would point out that trend doesn't seem to distinguish between states that have these canons and states that don't.
This is sort of a minority position in Wisconsin, right? I mean, their approach is not universally accepted.
In terms of the political affiliation, I believe the district court said that there were six states that had a ban. I don't know the exact number.
That's what I was referring to, Judge Graham's reference.
Yeah. I see that I'm out of time if there are no further questions.
Make a concluding statement if you wish.
Okay.
Mr. Neely.
Well, I just wanted to note that today is Constitution Day, so it's fitting that we're here speaking.
For us, every day is Constitution Day.
Well, it's fair enough. Fair enough. But I would ask the affirmance of the district court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Neely. Ms. Lattice.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to clarify, regarding the standard of review and the strict scrutiny standard, the distinction isn't between strict scrutiny and rational basis review here. What we're talking about is an intermediate level of scrutiny. The letter carrier's case obviously doesn't apply to judges. It applies to federal employees. But the idea here is the same. Similarly, in the Pickering cases, in the Garcetti case, that is to say where a individual's speech begins to interfere with the efficient and able performance of the job that that person is doing for the citizenry, then regulation of speech has been permitted. And that's what we're arguing here, that where a judge's speech interferes with the judiciary's ability to present as a nonpartisan, as a impartial body, that's where the judiciary ought to be able to regulate itself.
Well, just take on party identification. Mary Jones has been an active Democrat for 30 years. She becomes a circuit judge in Milwaukee County. And she just wants to remain identified as a Democrat. What's the state interest? I'm not talking about the extent of involvement. She just has always been a Democrat. It wants to be a Democrat.
Judges.
What state interest is?
State interest is that judges, that every litigant before that judge, including the Republicans, understand that that judge, when that judge puts on that robe, is nonpartisan.
But she's long known as a Democrat.
Yeah.
She has that history. She can't put that away.
We cannot put that away. But we can say, we're now saying that we're standing before you as nonpartisan. We're now a judge. We're putting that aside. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want.
You want her to not vote in primaries?
No, of course not. A judge should retain their right to vote. And as I said, we have an open primary.
In Indiana,
so
when you vote in a primary, you have to ask for a Democrat or a Republican ballot.
And you don't have to do that in Wisconsin. Right. Yeah. In fact, you can split your vote and go vote in the primary for governor for one and for something else for the other. So. And Regarding the solicitation clause, what I want to reiterate here is the very minor inconvenience that this really presents to judges raising money. I mean, Wisconsin has seen enormous increases in the amount of money that judges raise for political campaigns, even with the solicitation or with the solicitation clause as it stands. It does not seem to be causing anyone to have any trouble raising funds. And I think I commend to you the words of Chief Justice Abrahamson in supporting the rule. This rule, she said, represents a minor inconvenience to judicial candidates compared to the great and compelling public interest that no person feel directly or indirectly coerced by the presence of judges to contribute funds to judicial campaigns.
Is your message to the judge through this legislation that he or she must intentionally start to focus on having nothing to do with political parties or political once they take the oath of office? Is that the goal here, to help judges focus the mind?
That is certainly one of the goals of the judicial code, is to that you know, there's a lot of things that go on with a judge that are there for appearances. The judge,
this is apart from appearances. Is this the legislative intent that the judge will be better focused if he or she somehow totally distances himself from political activity?
Well, it's not the legislature. It's the court itself, the Supreme Court policing itself. That I don't know. None of them have ever articulated that that's their intention.
All right.
The one thing I wanted to correct then, and then I think that's the last thing, if there's no more questions, is when the political affiliation rule came into being, and it did come into being in 1968, that is when the Supreme Court first adopted any judicial code at all. So prior to that, it was an unwritten rule, and we've presented what evidence we have on that point that judges were not members of parties. But when they adopted the political or the judicial code in 1968, that was a component of it.
Thank you, Ms. Lattice. Thank you, Mr. Neely. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a short recess.